The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Just a little bit about today, which I'm telling you here just because we're stopped, because there's so much to see. First of all, as an overview, I'm going to show you. I've learned that showing maps on buses doesn't work. So we'll take out the map a little later. I'll give you a perception. We are actually going to be going along what's called Kav HaTefer, which is really where the border used to be. Okay, the border between us and Jordan was basically where your bus was sitting a few minutes ago, that valley. The other side of this hill, okay, we're on a road called Derech Chevron, Chevron Road. We are heading south, the path of the forefathers, right? Which is an old Roman road, the Temple Mount, Har HaBayit, okay? Very clearly, all right? The reches, the hilltops that are opposite Israel and opposite the old city, which is east of us, okay? One last technical detail while we walk. You are on a bulletproof bus. I wouldn't be taking you anywhere, and I certainly wouldn't be taking your ear anywhere that I didn't think was safe. But technically speaking, because we're going over the green line, in order to save all sorts of insurance challenges and waiver signing and all sorts of whatnot, there is one standard rule for a bulletproof bus. I don't think we're going to have this issue. I'd be amazed if we did. But, you know, better to mention it than not to mention it. If you're on a bulletproof bus and something actually does happen, like God forbid, so you don't want to get up and look around. The reason you don't want to get up and look around is because this is a Polish bulletproof bus. That's because the assumption is that you're sitting down. Got it? If you want to kind of lower yourself, something happens. But don't worry. Okay? Front window is not bulletproof. Okay, if they shoot out the front window, you got a bigger problem. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. This area on your left, by the way, is one of the last free sort of open fields in this area. And this is actually slated to be the American Embassy. I don't know if you know the whole controversy of the fact that the American Embassy has always been in Tel Aviv, even though Jerusalem is the capital. In every other country in the world, the American Embassy is in the capital city. But because of all the debates and the Arabs and the Jews, whatever, so various American governments did not want to make a statement. Eventually, America, due to pressure from Congress and the Senate, actually acquiesced and has made a decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem. And the ones holding up the process actually are the Israeli government. The Israeli government doesn't yet want America to move, because they don't want a big Tehran to upset, you know, current negotiations and political processes, etc. That was actually Rabin's hesitation after Oslo. But eventually this will be the American Embassy, and then we can get our passports freely. Well, now to get your passport, you have to go to East Jerusalem for consulate. Not pleasant. Okay, take a look, and you'll notice the architecture. We just passed an area called Abu Tor. Abu Tor, you may remember, was the village that sort of leads up all the way sort of the back towards Armon HaNativ. Armon HaNativ was the palace of the High Commissioner. It was a mountain that's sort of due south in the old city. Those of you who are with me, you could see it from our rooftop. And that Armon HaNativ is really sort of up that way, to your left, right? All of this area, okay, was Arab before 1948. Now, a lot of this is newly built and is, you know, wasn't settled at all. But you start to notice architecture that's much more Arabic in style, especially on your right, okay? And you can see very clearly the difference between Jewish housing that was built, like this building on our left, right? And older Arab houses that we're going to get to in a minute. All right, so if you look on your right here, okay, you'll see that this is all new Jewish housing, okay? And look on your left and you'll see that these are older Arab houses. See the difference? Okay. Now, by the way, you see these square block buildings, all right? So, in the early 1950s, right? You know, people talk about refugees. There was a whole different crowd of refugees back in the 1950s. Basically, after the War of Independence was won, the Arab countries were not exactly thrilled with the Jewish populations that were there, and since they couldn't take out their frustrations against the Jewish state, they began to take it out on the Jewish populations, and whole Jewish communities that had existed for thousands of years were in tremendous danger. So the Israeli government decided on a plan. Before I go there, take a look on your left, and you'll see a little guard position, okay? That was a British gun fort, and that marked actually the border in 1967, right? We are now entering what used to be Jordan. Okay, there was a tremendous battle. There was a very strategic spot on the road back in 1948. This tremendous battle that took place there between the Israelis and the Jordanian Legion, which we actually won. And that was what stopped the Jordanian Legion from coming in and taking over southern Jerusalem. All right, and that's left there as a landmark. If you look on your right, you'll see there's a whole area here. You see the caravans coming up on our right. You'll see them as we pass. That's a whole area called Givat HaMatos, which is like Plain Hill. And that's because in the Six-Day War, that was the only plane. There were only two planes that were downed in 1967 when the Israeli Air Force took out the entire Egyptian Air Force and 89% of the Syrian Air Force. We did lose two planes, and one of them fell here. Because this was then Jordan, it became a very serious issue, and they managed, there was a whole operation to get out the pilot. And ever since then, it's been called Plain Hill. And more recently, they settled Ethiopian Jews who were airlifted out in 1990, in Operation Moses, and they settled this hill. I'll get back to my previous story in a second. Look to your left, you can see Jordan very clearly. That's the mountains in the distance. All right, we're going to stop here for a second. We're going to stay on the bus, just so I can give you a little bit of overview as to what you're seeing on your left, okay? All right, you're going to see this more clearly later on, and I apologize for the windows. My advice is people on this side of the bus, stay seated, and that way people on this side of the bus can see, okay? All right, so these windows are a little hard to see through, but that's actually good when you think about why they're hard to see through. Just a little bit about what you're seeing. First of all, if you look behind you, okay, you can see Eliamunas, which is a site of a monastery that was a very, very strategic position. Now, think about the fact that we're heading south, okay? And if you look ahead of you, you can see very clearly the city of Beit Lechem, Bethlehem, okay? That has all sorts of biblical connotations, right? That's where King David came from, okay? That's where, in fact, it was called Beit Lechem because that's where they used to make the bread for the whole area, right? And to your half left in the distance, do you see there's a low hill with a very flat top? Okay, that's called the Herodion. Now, everybody knows about Masada, and tomorrow we're going to get to talk about King Herod and Masada. Herod was a king who lived at the end of the Second Temple period. His heyday was around 40 before the Common Era. He was an interesting character. Among other things, he was a paranoiac. He was convinced that everybody was trying to kill him. He was actually not Jewish. He was a puppet that was appointed by the Romans. He was the son of an Edomite woman, but he became the king because of his fealty to Rome and other political reasons that we don't have time for, and he was paranoid. He was convinced that the Jews were going to rebel against him and kill him. So in the course of his reign, he butchered over 30,000 Jews, which of course made that a self-fulfilling prophecy because people by the end wanted to kill him. However, in addition to everything else, he was also a master builder. And so he was a master builder, and one of the things that he did was he built fortresses. He was convinced that if the Jews would rise up against him, he wanted to be wherever he was in the country, he'd be near a fortress. And he supplied those fortresses. And Masada was his winter palace, because in the winter it's beautiful to be down by the Dead Sea. This was actually one of his summer palaces. And that's called Herodion. And it's actually beautiful on Tisha B'Av. For anybody who's here on Tisha B'Av, if you're not in the Old City visiting Israel, we do a whole program. That is another incredible place to go. They do an Eicha service out under the stars. And people come from the whole area. It's not the tourist experience of the Old City. It's a very different experience if you're around. The other thing that you can see very clearly on your left is the new neighborhood of Har Choma. Now, Har Choma made big news about 6 or 7 years ago because then Mayor Ehud Olmert approved the plans to build this whole new neighborhood. It was a big problem in Jerusalem. A lot of the young couples were moving away because they couldn't afford the housing. They wanted to build a whole housing project that has room for 20,000 people. However, the Arabs were vehemently against it because they claimed that it was Arab land, that technically, if you think about which direction we're headed in south, that makes that east. Technically, that's over the Green Line, which it is. Technically, it's East Jerusalem, and therefore we're building, you know, Jewish housing in East Jerusalem. This hill was a completely barren hill. Never any Arabs lived here. The real reason that the Arabs were so upset about this, okay, which was probably the real reason that Olmert wanted it built here, and I'm not commenting on right or wrong, you don't really get unless you're here. Think about the fact that Yerushalayim is behind us. Beit Lechem is ahead of us, okay? And the Arabs want, and Arafat especially wanted, to create Jerusalem as the center, as the capital of the Arab state. So he kind of began to get a sense that he would never get all of Jerusalem, so he wanted to get Abu Dis, which we're going to see tomorrow, which is just over the hilltops opposite the old city of Jerusalem, right, to the east, and it's basically that way. And so there's East Jerusalem, and there's Beit Lechem, and now you've got Har Chomas sitting right in the middle. So you can't have a contiguous, uninterrupted Arab presence from Jerusalem to Beit Lechem. And this is really part of the political struggle for who really owns Jerusalem, okay? The right side of Har Choma, the real estate value went way down in the year 2000. And everyone guess why? Right, because they're in firing range from Beit Lechem. They didn't actually get a lot of bullets there because it hadn't been settled yet, so they didn't want to waste their bullets on empty houses. But this side of Har Choma is selling like hotcakes. Only in Israel could you have a real estate agent tell you, well, this is out of the firing range, this is in the firing range. That's a different way of buying an apartment. Yeah, it's 60% settled already, okay? Alright, we're going to head towards the Gush Etzion. We're going to take a stop in another minute for another overview. No, not right now. Right now all is quiet. We're going to get to talk about that a little later, why I think it's quiet now and what that means. Just to go back to the story I was telling you before, do you remember those big square buildings? Okay? Now hang on 1 second. By the way, ahead of you is the checkpoint into Beit Lechem, Bethlehem. That's the way, that was the old road, that's the way we used to drive. You know, when I moved to Efrat in 1989, 88, until 96, when this road that we're about to go on was open, you basically had to go through Beit Lechem, past the refugee camp of Dahisha, a very different experience. We didn't have bulletproof cars, so. But back then they weren't using bullets. Ahead of us is the neighborhood of Gilo. Now some of you may recognize the name Gilo. I'm going to talk about that in a second when we stop. But just to finish the previous story, so you saw all those big square blocks of housing. In 1950, there were 880,000 Jews living in Arab lands. And at that time, there were 600,000 Jews living in Israel. And Israel decided they had to find a way to bring these Jews home because they were in tremendous danger. There was a blood libel in Damascus that year in 1951. There were pogroms in Iraq. And so basically Operation Magic Carpet, Mavada Ksamim, began. Between 1950 and 1953, 850,000 Jews came to Israel. Think about this. 850,000 Jews were brought to a country that had 600,000 people. Okay? That means that they took on 130% of their population. That'd be the equivalent of 420 million people immigrating to America in the next 3 years. The whole economy would collapse. And they were refugees. And they were forced out of their countries in some instances. In other instances, they ran in the middle of the night. They could not take anything with them. They left their homes, most of their property, you know, behind. To this day, there's never been any system of reparations for the Jews who were forced to leave all of those countries. The best example I can think of is that in southern Iraq, there is a city called Sura. And in Sura, there is a yeshiva, which is called the Sura Yeshiva. And this yeshiva was one of the two yeshivot where the Talmud was edited and written. And it was the longest standing yeshiva in the world. In 1948, it had been a yeshiva that was in operation approximately 1,650 years. Uninterrupted. It was closed by the Iraqi government in 1948. And that, for the Jews of Iraq, was the symbol that it was time to go. They actually had a legend that when the Sura Yeshiva were closed, it would mean that redemption was at hand. You can do with that what you want. And so those Jews came here to Israel. We had nowhere to settle them. We had no housing for them. So they built tent cities all over the country. It took 15 years to get the last of the immigrants out of... to get the last of the immigrants out of the what were called the Ma'barot, the refugee camps, tent cities, etc. And the reason that I'm mentioning this to you, first of all, it's interesting that gradually they needed a plan for mass housing. They didn't have time to sort of build you know, villas to tailor to these needs. So they build housing all over the country. We'll see more of it tomorrow. And they're basically blocks of housing with small apartments that people could at least move into with electricity and running water and whatnot. And in 15 years, they resettled basically or built housing for almost 1 million people. Think about 15 years, 850,000 people from Arab countries and the population growth, right? 1 million people. The social implications that affected the fabric of Israeli society are still being felt today. Tremendous problems between Sephardic Jews, Ashkenazic Jews, etc., that are just now starting to sort of be put down on the table and people are starting to move on. To this day, there are still socioeconomic challenges. You think about what it means to grow up in a tent city and all sorts of other challenges that, you know, we don't have time to talk about right now, but I'll be happy to later. The most fascinating thing that I think is worth considering is that a tiny state with very little resources succeeds in resettling 1 million refugees because it's important to them. 22 Arab countries with the wealth of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, etc., have not succeeded in resettling less than 1 million Arab refugees in approximately 60 years. So that gives you pause for thought. Now, what that means, what the implications are, of all the days that we're going to spend together, this is the day that it is most difficult for me personally not to sort of get into a political bent. And I'm really going to try, because I think you have to try to present facts, and it's not healthy for, you know, it's not like I have somebody else up here to present the opposite view. So I'm going to try to share with you both perceptions, but realize that I'm about as unobjective on this topic as you can imagine, all right? And over the course of the day, if you have questions, we'd be glad to do that. Back to our current show. So, we are now facing, again, south. Now, Gilo, the neighborhood of Gilo, which did not exist 25 years ago, okay, is built up on the left, all right, or on your right, okay? And there are back areas with beautiful, beautiful villas. There's actually a magnificent park here called Park Gilo, which is just incredible to take your children to if they're like, I don't know, under the age of like eight and under, with slides and ropes and whatever. It's actually very easy to get to. There's a magnificent JCC-type facility with pools and whatever, also not far from here in Yerushalayim down the hill. And this actually is interesting, although we're not going to get it. This is actually a Catholic church graveyard. Remember the monastery that we passed that was over there? So they used to bury their dead here. This was way in the middle of nowhere. This was a barren area. There was nothing here, no settlement, no nothing. And they planted, there's a Catholic graveyard here that goes back to the 1850s. Technically, this is Israeli state land, but because it's a Catholic graveyard, out of respect for the church, so this has been fenced off and nobody does anything here. These are actually olive groves that the Arabs planted some time back. And if you look as we drive now, you're going to see that up on your right is very clearly the neighborhood of Gilo. Gilo is really a suburb of Jerusalem. Okay? Now, if you look on your left, you're going to see Beit Lechem. In fact, not only are you going to see Beit Lechem, the Arab city of Beit Lechem, on your left, right? You're going to see it on top of you because we're about to go into a tunnel underneath it. That's because the road used to run over there, used to run through Beit Lechem, and in the first intifada, with all the problems, and the fact that they were looking at, you know, structuring the map differently in terms of a peace agreement, Israel came to the conclusion they had to build a road that circumvented some of these problems. Whether they succeeded or not, I'll let you be the judge of, but they built a tunnel road, which, at least from our perspective, is a magnificent road. It has the longest tunnel in Israel. It also has the highest bridge in Israel. We're going to go on a bridge over what's called the Valley of Rephaim, the Valley of Ghosts. There's an interesting legend about that. The Arabs claim that the ghosts of the ancients who lived there, the Jews who lived there, populate that valley, and that one day they'll come back to reoccupy their valley, and that's why the Arabs never built down in that valley, which is interesting because today we're back. But anyway, so we're going to take that road. In the year 2000, this road became unfortunately infamous because of the Palestinian gun positions that were firing from Beit Lechem into Gilo. Okay, specifically on the far road, we don't have time to go into the neighborhood, but you'll be able to see it very clearly. You'll be able to see there's a range of 1,600 yards, right? And in some places as little as 800 yards between the edge of Arab Beit Lechem and your right, which will be Gilo. Okay? And it gives you kind of a perspective of what we're talking about. It's also interesting that on CNN, it's the first time anybody had thought of Gilo as a settlement. Okay, CNN kept saying that the settlement of Gilo is being fired on. Israelis always thought this was a neighborhood of Jerusalem. It's part of the natural extension. In fact, if you look at the history, for example, of New York, so Queens and Brooklyn are suburbs of New York, right? They were built and settled mostly by Jewish immigrants, late 1800s, 1900s. If you would have gone to New York in 1820, Brooklyn didn't exist. But Brooklyn isn't a settlement. Brooklyn is like a suburb of New York. So that's an interesting propaganda political game. You don't really get it until you come here and drive to the edge of Yerushalayim and you see. The other thing that's interesting is we have this perception that there's Beit Lechem over there and Jerusalem over here. Here you're going to see very clearly that Beit Lechem sits on the edge of Jerusalem. Right? Life is not quite so simple. Okay? I'm not talking yet about solutions about whether we could find a way to live together and how to do that, but in terms of sort of the complications of having two populations that live so closely intertwined. The third thing that I want you to notice, and that's why I'm stopping here because there's a lot to say, it's a very quick ride, is you will notice on your left the gray wall. That is the wall, fence, whatever you want to call it, okay, that Israel is building. In some places you'll see here very clearly that it stops, and that's because there's a case pending in the Supreme Court about a particular Arab family's land that the wall has to go to. What's interesting, by the way, about that case is that it should be an open and shut case. Does anybody here know what the right of eminent domain is? Yeah. Right? You build a highway, so you have the right, you know, it goes to court, and the state always wins because you have the right to fulfill the needs of the community first. It'd be hard to imagine a case where the right of eminent domain doesn't apply more than a security wall, fence, whatever, which is saving lives. And I asked a friend of mine who's a lawyer about this, and he said, technically this should be an open and shut case. Israel's very concerned about its image in the world, in the UN, and therefore they prefer that this case drag on so that it appears that, you know, that they've given it due consideration. That's an interesting question. I myself had great hesitations about the wall. I'm not going to tell you what they were, what they are, and whether they still are, but just to consider, sort of, now you kind of get what you're looking at. So we're going to ride past Beit Lechem. We're going to head out to Gush Etzion, and I'll tell you the history of Gush Etzion when we get there. Any questions before we roll? Yes. The church is the single largest owner of property in Israel. They own more property. The church owns more real estate than the state of Israel. That's a whole interesting discussion. Don't know. No, they do. They have large properties. Before the first Intifada, a couple of friends of mine, we used to do this every Friday afternoon. We'd finish our learning Friday morning when I was in Yeshiva. You're going to see what I'm talking about. And we used to go hitchhike into Beit Lechem. Solomon's pools. You could dive off walls into pools of what was then clean water. And we would walk around Beit Lechem. Unbelievable. Oh, you can't hear me? Unbelievable churches and history. I mean, there's a lot of Jewish history in Beit Lechem, but that's another discussion. Okay? One more question, then we're going to roll. Yes?
So is this disputed?
This is an interesting question. Is that disputed? Just to answer this question briefly, okay? If you go to Tel Aviv, and you go to the beach, and you go into the water about, I'd say, 60 feet into the water, you actually get to a point that it's over your head. That's not disputed.
Right. Okay.
Got it?
Everything's
disputed around here. Got it? That's where they want the next state of Israel, but I guess my colors are showing. All right. But yes, technically this is over the green line. The green line, which I'm going to mention a few times today, the green line is an interesting thing. People think the green line is kind of because of the trees and the shrubbery. What happened was that after the Six-Day War, when the dust settled, and I'm going to show you this on a map afterwards, Israel had kind of straightened out its borders, so the UN brokered a ceasefire. And this wasn't, a ceasefire. It wasn't like, well, what do you want, what do I want? Israel basically said, we're willing to stop shooting, you know, but since we've taken over half of your territory in 6 days, you might be nervous about what would happen if there was a 12-day war, so they agreed to a ceasefire, right? Remember that Egypt, as an example, had just lost their entire air force. Israel had sent an artillery barrage into Cairo, because they went to a military base just on the edge of Cairo. They wanted to demonstrate to the Egyptians, we're not going back down this road again, right? So the Arabs were willing to mark a ceasefire. When they sat down and marked up the map, the marker that they happened to use was a green marker. So it became known as the green line. Eventually, it became a green line because the places on this side of the border of 67, which had been Arab, were barren. The Arabs weren't into planting and trees. They used most of the border areas with Israel as a staging ground, sort of to prepare to launch the next war. You're going to see this very clearly in the Golan when we're up there on Thursday, right? Today, it's not so apparent in that fashion just because we've done a lot of planting. But so over the green line means you've entered an area that in 1967 became ours again, depending on your political perspectives, okay? That's what the green line means. Got it? Okay, so we're now in an area, the old city of Jerusalem, the Kotel, is over the green line, okay? Because the Kotel was not ours, we took it in 67. We got it back in a ceasefire agreement. When Yasser Arafat says he wants to go back to pre-1967 borders, that means giving up the old city of Jerusalem, just so you understand what the point of contention is, and all of Gilo. Pardon? No, I'll show you on the map. Okay, it says no.
Are we going to have the actual border between our territory and...
Well, you're on the border. You'll see.
Say goodbye.
You'll be on the border between us and Syria on Thursday, and you will see the border with Jordan tomorrow. And if the Arabs have their way, you'll be on the border soon, because... All right, look to your left in a minute, and you'll see Beit Lechem. This fence, by the way, on our right, is totally the result of the events of the year 2000. This did not used to exist. But the people in Gilo, on your right. Now, imagine you live on one of these houses here on your right. It's a beautiful area. You build a villa. This wasn't a political decision. It was just good land. And opposite you is Beit Lechem. And you can see the wall very clearly here. Okay? And you can see that crane down in the distance here. There's a break in the wall. That's a Supreme Court decision. But it still makes it a lot easier for the army to monitor. This is a very sophisticated wall. This is actually one of Israel's few propaganda successes. When I'm not with friends, when I'm not in Israel, I don't call this the wall, I call this the fence. Israel decided to call it the fence so that people won't think it's like the Berlin Wall. All right, but this is Beit Lechem on your left, okay? Now all of this road is new. Okay, this was carved out of the mountain. If you look ahead of you, all right, you'll see a tall gray tower at the bottom of the hill. That was an Israeli gun position. Those were put in, you'll see a few of them on the road. They were put in as a result of the events of the year 2000. Now look, you'll see that Gilo's up on your right, and you'll see that the Arab village of Beit Jala is up on your left. You're going to see it more clearly in a minute. And this was the fire zone. Okay? It became a very difficult road to drive. By the way, we should say a big thank you to our bus driver, Shlomi. I want you to know, the day usually depends on the driver. So far, we're in good luck. Now, look on your left. You used to be able to see a much nicer view here. This is bulletproof sheeting that was put up here because there were terrorists that were opening up on this road. There are three Israelis who were killed along this road. We'll get to that. That's Emek Rafaim, the valley of the Ghost, down to your right. And that actually leads to the valley of Beitar, which is where the Bar Kokhba rebellion ended. Look up on your left, and you'll see a building, a square building, okay? You see, like, this end of it, right under the antenna, is kind of burnt out.
Yeah.
That was a Palestinian terrorist gun position. They were firing, in fact, in one instance, they fired an anti-tank missile, and so an Israeli helicopter finally took out the building. This whole village up on your left is Beit Jala. This is a Christian Arab village. The people who live here did not want to be involved in the fighting. Tanzim, Arab terrorists, moved in to this village in 2000, took it over, and they were firing into Gilo. Some terrible stories. I mean, you know, a woman who was bathing her child in the bathroom, and a bullet came through and killed her while she was bathing her child, and other such terrible stories. Eventually, the residents of Gilo, especially on Anafar Street, were all given bulletproof windows by the Israeli government. Big, very big controversial decision. You know, that the solution to violence is to bulletproof our windows instead of solving them. And all sorts of, you can imagine how this went in the news. There is a street, this is, by the way, the longest tunnel in Israel. We are going underneath Beit Lechem. Alright? We used to have to drive through Beit Lechem, which was a much more challenging issue. You know, part of the problem is the balance between what the military knows how to do and what politics needs to do. And I'm not defining one as right or wrong, but they live with a certain tension with each other, and this is a perfect example. I remember on the third night of the war, in 2000, I got a draft notice basically to show up that night, right after Rosh Hashanah, and for 3 days, we were like running like chickens all over the place. And none of us had ever experienced this. You know, until this point, I mean, war was like up in Lebanon. Now all of a sudden, you know, I told you this the other day. You went out to patrol. You got into a gunfight, and then 7 o'clock you came home, had dinner with the family, caught up on some email, and went out to fight again. Very, very strange experience. Okay, and by the third night of the war, I mean things were just out of control. They were firing on civilians on a regular. This is a regular one of the main arteries of Israel. So they called us together, all the company and battalion commanders, and we were the brigade commander, and we were sort of having a meeting. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, sort of a plan about how to proceed and when this was going to end and et cetera. And at one point, one of the battalion commanders raises his hand, and he's talking to this brigade commander, a very accomplished fellow, and he says, "I don't understand what's going on here." So it's 3 days, we're running like chickens, they're firing on the road, they're firing on civilians. Makalepo, what's going on? What he wants it, right? So the battalion commander says, "Look, you need to understand. There is a military solution here, but the military solution is simply that we have to take over Beit Jala." Right? Beit Jala was that Arab Christian village. It sits on top of the road there. The only way to stop people firing from their village is to take it over. You can't defend the road. I mean, it's too wide and too big. What are you going to do? You're going to build a steel canopy over the road? It doesn't work, right? So that's the only way to do it. And that is the solution, right? The best defense is an offense. Most of our success in avoiding suicide bombings, terrorism. By the way, this is El Khader. This is El Khader. There's a terrible story here about a week into the war, sort of the left and up behind us, and this village here specifically. Terrible story here. There was we got a call. There were two terrorists who were up on that ridge. They were firing down the road, and a Jeep patrol just sort of happened into the line of fire and got hit, and one of the soldiers was killed, and one of the soldiers sort of sprawled out on the road, deep in, a few hundred yards in, where they'd gone to investigate. So the second Jeep came along, and this was the deputy company commander. And I'm not sure exactly why he did this, no one will ever know, but witnesses afterwards said that they could hear the groans, the cries of this Israeli soldier who was wounded, who was lying out in that field, and that he was in their line of fire. And the deputy company commander should have waited for more reinforcements, but I guess the thought of an Israeli soldier lying out there wounded just got to him. So he took one of his men, who set up a cover fire position, and he moved in to get this guy. And he managed to get to the guy, and he managed to put him on his shoulder, and he was bringing him out when the terrorists took both of them out. And they were both there. There were three dead that day. And the theory is that the terrorists could have taken them out at any time. They waited until he had him on his shoulders, because they wanted to make it that much more demoralizing. Very, very difficult stories that happened here. But in any event, and so that was more of a political decision, because at that point, to move into Beit Lechem, sort of post-Oslo, was a very, very big decision. Yeah, here you can see also the edge of Beit Lechem. This is the continuity of El Khader, which leads up towards Gush Etzion. Now, I'm going to tell you the story of Gush Etzion when we're out of the bus and you can hear me a little better. You can see how intertwined these areas are. If you look, these are all, by the way, this didn't used to be here. This is all the result of anytime you pass those kind of cement bottles, you're basically passing an area where something happened. And the result was they decided to put up protective walls and other sheeting. This is the old entrance to Beit Lechem. When you used to drive through Bethlehem, this is where you used to come out. And today, that's an Arab road. Jews don't drive there. It's not considered a smart thing to do. Okay? So now you see that Beit Lechem is right behind this hill. Okay? And in a minute, you'll see that Efrat is on the other side of this hill. Beit Lechem, before the first Intifada, of course, to a one intifada. Intifada means an uprising. That was another Arab propaganda success. The first intifada started in 1988. And when you can hear me better, remind me, and I'll be glad to tell you how it started and why. But before the first intifada, Beit Lechem was 70% Christian Arab. It's a very Christian city, right? I mean, that's where, you know, they believe Jesus.
Beit Shalem is Christian.
Right. And most of Beit Lechem was Christian. By the end of the Intifada and post-Oslo today, Beit Lechem is about 25% Christian. Because look on your left, by the way, you'll see the city of Efrat, which is part of Gush Etzion, happens to be where I live. see it spreads out on the hilltops here. These hills have been barren for 2,000 years, right? But you see that you're about, what, 10, 15 minutes.
How long are we doing? About 10 minutes?
So you're 10 minutes from Jerusalem. It's nothing. You're also 2 minutes from Beit Lechem. The northern tip of Efrat could walk to Beit Lechem in 15 minutes, 20 minutes. Okay? These are all, we're going to see these from the hill, so I won't start getting into what's what. But you can see the edge of Neve Daniel, which is going to be up on our right. Neve Daniel is actually named after a boy who fell in the Lebanon War. One of the ways that people decided to react to Arab aggression terrorism was there was a period of time where they felt every time a Jew is killed, we're going to build another town. And eventually they'll stop killing Jews because they don't want us to be building towns. And there are many who credit the end of the Intifada with that philosophy. Whether that's true or not is an interesting debate. No, not the current one, the previous one. Now the current one, it's interesting. The current one, which began in 2000, has calmed down. The general opinion is very simple. They believe that, most people in Israel believe that Sharon's policy of targeted, killing the, assassinating the leaders of the Intifada is what put it to an end. I have to agree with them, but other this up here is Elazar. It's named after after Elazar the Maccabee, who fell in this area 2,200 years ago. It's a beautiful horse farm. Take your kids horseback riding, or you can go on horseback riding. Journeys through the mountains here. You can see Efrat is a series of hills. Okay, we're going to be going into Efrat now. I'm going to take you to an overview. This is one of the northernmost hills, the hill of Geffen. Right, this is the bottom of Geffen. You can see up here the basketball courts and the tennis courts. This is where I live. I live up where, not far from where those antennae are. What would happen if Arabs decided to build here?
Yeah, I know right now it's Jewish.
Well, you have to understand, to build in this country, you have to go through a process. You need to buy land, then you need to have building permits approved and zoning approved. Technically speaking, an Arab could buy here, and he could build here. This is a city. This is not a settlement, a yeshuv, a town. Towns have acceptance committees. Never mind an Arab. If you wanted to move into Alon Shuit, there's a group, a committee that meets, you know, once a month, and they decide whether to approve you, just like on a kibbutz. In Efrat, that's not the case. So in Efrat, if an Arab wanted to live here, he could. As a matter of fact, why an Arab doesn't is an interesting question. I mean, it's like anywhere else. Would I move into an all-Argentinian community? Probably not, you know, because... there is an interesting story here. You see these vineyards? Okay? So when Efrat was zoned, and they started building Efrat, the Arabs in the area realized they were going to build a Jewish area. Okay? So there's a statute under Turkish law that if you farm, which is still part of Israeli law is a conglomeration. We're entering Efrat now, obviously. And on our right is the hill of Rimon. This is Pomegranate Hill up here. Okay? All the hills are named after the seven species, the seven fruits of the land of Israel. Okay? Right? So there's a statute that if you farm land for 3 years, the land becomes yours. One of the agricultural realities of this area is vines. I mean, you know, they've been producing wine in this area for thousands of years, and one of the reasons is this land is suitable for vines, and they grow very quickly. So the Arabs started planting vines around Efrat. And of course, back then, this was a barren hill. It wasn't like people came out here every day. When they eventually noticed it, they had to decide what to do. You, by the way, look on the distant hills. You will see Alon Shvut, right, sort of directly across. You'll see that a little later. And Elazar, which is the village on the hill opposite. Right, that's a smaller town. It looks like a continuation of Efrat, but the highway actually runs in between us. And this is the top side of Geffen, of Vine Hill, that I showed you before. Beautiful houses here. This is one of Efrat's 27 synagogues. Okay, there are about 10,000, actually close to 11,000 Jews who live here now. It's a mixed community. They're religious and irreligious, whatever those definitions mean. But the overwhelming majority are what you would probably call Orthodox. When they were planting Efrat, they didn't know what to do. And they decided that they didn't want to build a city by uprooting vineyards. So they put watchmen out to make sure that they didn't plant anymore, and they built the city, they replanned the plans, and they built the city around those vineyards. And to this day, they let Arabs come in and farm that land. It's not much of it. Kind of a model of what could be. Here on your right is another example. This is an Arab vineyard that was planted here illegally, but they let them plant it because they didn't want to create a big political ruckus. No, they claimed the right to those vineyards. In fact, it was Mazel that we caught them before they planted all area. I mean, when you stand up here and you look at all the hilltops, and look how much land there is here, you know? You kind of like take a step back and you wonder, what are we all fighting about? It seems so silly. Right. And it's unfortunate. Yes. Oh, back to the problem, okay. This is the neighborhood of Dekel, okay? This is Palm Tree Hill. My brother lives down below here. My brother-in-law lives back there. I have another brother who lives in El Azhar across the way. So we have good barbecues. We passed before, I'm sorry, I didn't mention pointing out one of the schools. This is another one of the schools. There are four, I think, elementary schools in Efrat. There are three high schools. Five high schools. They don't blow up the windows. Some of these high schools are award-winning schools. For example, the Asiach High School won the President's Award 2 years ago. This is the award you get for the best school in the country. Unbelievable educational system here. Up behind this hill, right, this is one of three forests in Efrat, which really are important for dads who have sons who want to go camping, but the dads are too lazy to go anywhere. So this is like, you know, kind of like downtime zone.
Are there secular schools here or there are usually just...
No, here they're all religious schools, but there are families here who have arranged... This is the edge of Palm Tree, Dekel Hill. Now we're entering Zaith. This is the newest hill in Efrat. Okay, the Olive Hill, right? And now you can see Neve Daniel across the valley. It's very, very clearly. It's the highest point in the area. Incredible view from up there. I don't think we're going to have a chance to go up there. And more than that, an unbelievable bakery. Which is why we're not going up there, because my wife gave me specific orders. No. Kach smola,
איפה שהגן,
אתה מכיר פה הגן?
Is it like pink or private school, basically?
No, yeshiva schools. The schools here, even though they're religious schools, are not private schools. They're publicly funded. And, in fact, one of the best reasons I could think of to make Aliyah, when I was in Boca, the last year I was in Boca, and I got a letter in the mail from the Hillel Day School that said that the tuition for the coming year for my four children was $48,000. Then I came back to Israel and quite excitedly discovered that for all my kids together I'm paying about, I'd say maybe $6,000, not even, with books and trips and everything all together. By the way, get a look here. This is the new, you can see they're still building houses here. Look at Beit Lechem, which is straight ahead of us. All right. In the distance is a hill called Dagan. I'm going to tell you about that when we get off the bus. And we're just turning around here so that you can all get off on the right side of the street. This really gives you an idea. All right, here's what we're going to do. Okay? We're going to get off the bus here. We're going to walk up these steps to our right.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.